And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
وَذُرْوَةُ سَلَامِهِ الْجِهَاد. That really the acme of this is this struggle. And jihad means defending the lands of the Muslims. It means all of the other things. There's jihad al-asghar wal-akbar. And that division is absolutely sound division recognized by all of the ulama. This idea, because the hadith is weak, رَجَعْنَا مِنَ الْجِهَادِ الْأَصْغَرِ إِلَى الْجِهَادِ الْأَكْبَرِ. That hadith, the meaning is sound. And the ulama have always accepted that. That the greater jihad is the jihad of the self or the soul, and the lesser jihad is the jihad of the enemy. So the inward enemies, the four inward, inshallah we'll get to that, the four inward enemies, and if you conquer those inward enemies, the outward enemies are nothing. They're nothing. But the inward enemies are the real enemies of the human being. And then he says, ثم قال ألا أخبرك بملاك ذلك كله. Can I tell you how to get all of this? Do you want to know how you can get all of this? I mean, this is an amazing statement. Do you want to know how you can obtain all of that? And then he says, فَأَخَذَ بِلِسَانِهِ. That blessed tongue that had all those meanings that flowed from it and all that wisdom. He took his tongue. He took hold of his tongue. And he said to him, كُفَّ عَلَيْكَ هَذَا. Just control this. Just control your tongue. That's the milak. That's how تَمْلِكُهُ. You'll be able to possess all of those other things if you do this jihad. And then قُدْسُ يَا نَبِيَ اللَّهُ. He's amazed. Right? Mu'adh. يَا نَبِيَ اللَّهُ وَإِنَّا لَمُؤَخَذُونَ بِمَا نَتَكَلَّمُ بِهِ. Are we going to be taken to account for what we're talking? Because the Arabs, to them, speech was not action. Their understanding was a man could have words, but he had to be a man of deeds. And the Ayyam al-Arab are all about deeds. The words glorified the deeds. Right? Their poetry was glorification of deeds. And so he's saying, are we going to be taken to account for what we say? And then he says, فَقَادَ ثَكِرَتْكَ أُمُّكَ. Right? And this is an Arab idiom that, even though it literally means like your mother is weeping over you as if you've died, you know, but it's a hyperbole to say you're really missing the point here, you know. And he said, تَكِدَتْكَ أُمُّكَ وَهَلْ يَكُبَّ النَّاسَ فِي النَّارِ عَلَى وُجُوهِهِمْ أَوْ قَالَ عَلَى مَنَاخِرِهِمْ إِلَّا حَصَائِدُ أَلْسِنَتِهِمْ. Will people be dragged in the hell on their faces, or he said on their noses, by other than the harvest of their tongues? The harvest of their tongues. So this is, I mean, that hadith should be enough to tell you the importance of the tongue.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Ya fuadi da'asi wallah fawid al-amr lillahi lillah qul wa nadi hasbi allah qul fama khaba abdun da'a allah. لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
South Africans are calling on their government to withdraw its permission to Shell Oil for a seismic survey along the country's pristine wild coast region. Now, this area is home to some of the country's most undisturbed marine life and a major source of income for locals. Last December, protesters gathered in Cape Town and chanted slogans against Shell, an Anglo-Dutch multinational oil and gas company. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on Shell's move to create a 3D model of offshore oil and gas reserves by using seismic waves in South Africa's wild coast region. Environmentalists say the operation will not only affect marine creatures, but also fishing communities in the wild coast whose livelihoods depend on the marine life. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about Zimbabwean health professionals who are leaving their country amid the COVID-19 pandemic to work in the United States, Britain, Australia, and neighboring countries. Stay tuned as our experts give you their insight on these two subjects.
Go to hell, Shell. Weeks after the 26th UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where leaders discussed urgent action to end the climate crisis, Shell, an Anglo-Dutch multinational oil and gas company, is pressing ahead with a controversial seismic survey of potential oil and gas deposits off South Africa's coast. The survey is being carried out off what's known as the country's wild coast, where whales and dolphins are frequently spotted. Locals are saying the survey will also impact negatively on their livelihoods.
I don't want them to operate here because if they do, we won't be able to fish here. All these sea creatures will die or we won't catch anything. They shouldn't work here. What are we going to eat? It should stop.
Environmental activists and human rights organizations have also joined locals in opposing this project. One of the activists speaks here on why they oppose the Shell's seismic survey.
You know, I mean, the key thing is that the energy agencies have already told us that we have enough oil and gas reserves, enough. We don't need more, so this is entirely speculative. We don't know that there is oil and gas there. We don't know that it will be needed in 10 to 15 years. We know that we have solar and wind energy in abundance, that if we invested the money in, that we would be able to replace the coal that's going. And we also know that there is an impact on the ecosystem, you know, and it starts from the zooplankton. We know that it kills zooplankton. Now, that's the start of the food chain.
However, South Africa's Minister for Natural Resources and Energy, Gwede Mantashe, has rejected claims that the Shell seismic survey will damage the environment.
Seismic surveys have been undertaken for decades globally in search of oil and gas. They are used for the identification of hydrocarbon-bearing structures and subsurface rock formations that must contain oil and gas. Seismic source is not an explosion or a blast in the ocean as purported by some in the media.
Now, for more on the controversy surrounding Shell's seismic survey of the South African coast, we have contacted Nimo Basse, an environmental activist, author and director of Health of Matarat Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, first tell us, how will these seismic surveys affect communities living along the South African coast?
Ecosystems are not neutral spaces. They are spaces of life, of very complex relationships. And so when you have seismic surveys in coastal waters, they have direct implications for coastal communities. This is because the seismic surveys do impact the aquatic ecosystem. They do lead to the death of big sea mammals and animals. This leads to destruction of so many species. And so communities whose lives depend on the health of the coastal ecosystem have every right to be worried about what's going on in that space. Their culture, their economy, their spirituality, their social life, their education, they're all tied in a complex web with the quality of the coastal ecosystem. And so everyone, anyone living in that territory should be worried, and they have a right to be worried.
Seismic surveys have been used for many decades in both onshore and offshore mineral and oil exploration. Such surveys are also common along the South African coast. So why did this particular survey provoke public outcry in South Africa and beyond? Early December, the Eastern Cape Division of the Makanda High Court in South Africa rejected an urgent application brought by environmentalists and local communities to stop the seismic survey by Royal Dutch Shell off the Wild Coast. A protester voiced his disappointment over the judgment.
I find it absolutely ridiculous that the appeal was rejected. We know the dangers that, you know, fossil fuel consumption has done to this planet.
It's really very interesting when the judge said that they're looking for well-rounded apprehension of irreparable damage to marine life. Now, I think this is taking judicial argument to a new level. Now, the people know what the impact of seismic survey is, and they know that this seismic survey is not an end to itself. The judge has to look at what happens after the seismic survey. If the seismic survey confirmed that fossil fuel resources, either natural gas or crude oil, to be extracted, what would be the impact of the extractive activity on the livelihoods of the people, on the quality of the aquatic ecosystem, on the quality of the South African coastline? These are the bigger questions that need to be asked. What will happen to the climate when they extract fossil fuels and burn them to release more carbon into the atmosphere? So the issue is not as simple as just being opposed to a seismic survey. The people are defending their future.
However, following a successful appeal in late December, the High Court in Makanda ordered the Anglo-Dutch oil giant to immediately cease its seismic blasting along the ecologically sensitive coast. The ruling forms part of a broader court application contending Shell did not have the necessary environmental approvals.
The mess created by Shell is a clear example of how big oil companies tend to divert responsibility for the damages to the health, livelihoods, and environments of communities where they operate. Now, a Nigerian villager speaks here on how Shell destroyed local environment in the Niger Delta region.
Christmas tree, this is the name that Shell gives that this technology. This is the source of this pollution. This is how every other 54 from which this state and, of course, the entire world feeds.
Now, Mr. Basse, do you think what happened in Niger Delta influenced opposition to Shell activities in South Africa?
Shell's infamous activities in the Niger Delta are very well known across the world, and they provide the people with a very clear template if they want to see the future of fossil fuel extraction. And so the people have a right to learn, and I believe that what they've heard from the Niger Delta have given them very clear information about what could happen if these seismic activities are allowed and then proceeds onto fossil fuel extraction off the coast of South Africa. The Niger Delta has been totally damaged, one of the most polluted places on planet Earth. The soil polluted, the air polluted, the water polluted, the life of the people utterly contaminated. Indeed, fossil fuel extraction by oil companies in the Niger Delta have completely challenged the right to life of the people, the right to safe water of the people, and the right to safe food of the people. And the people of South Africa should learn the lesson that what is coming is extremely destructive.
Well, thanks for that, Mr. Basse. By the way, the fight to stop Shell's planned seismic survey off South Africa's Wild Coast is being pursued through the country's judicial system. We shall now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss Zimbabwe's medical brain drain amid the COVID-19 pandemic. So stay with us.
You're
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
A large number of Zimbabwean health professionals have left the country amid the COVID-19 pandemic to work in the United States, Britain, Australia, and neighboring states.
According to the government's Health Service Board, more than 2,200 left the country in 2021, and this is more than double the number of doctors, nurses, and pharmacists who left last year, and three times the number that left in 2019. United Nations Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures, Elena Doohan, believes the United States and European Union sanctions on Zimbabwe have contributed to unemployment of doctors in the country, which naturally compels doctors to look for greener pasture abroad.
The designation of senior state officials, as well as companies owned or controlled by them, makes foreign companies and banks unwilling to do business with Zimbabwe's public sector, preventing the government from getting revenue for the exercise of its public functions and provision of essential services, resulting in the violation of labor and social rights of people involved in the public sector, whose salaries are reported to be much lower than in the private sphere. This has led to rising unemployment, especially among the most qualified professionals, like engineers, doctors, teachers, university professors, judges, and police officers.
Now, the problem faced by Zimbabwe is actually a common problem in Africa. A Zimbabwean medical doctor and activist laments that many African doctors are now working in the United States while people in their home countries continue to suffer.
It's because the majority of the healthcare workers are outside Africa. Like I often say, there are more Ghanaian doctors in New York City than in Ghana, the country. There are more Nigerian doctors in Los Angeles than in the country of Nigeria. How then do you improve healthcare if there are no doctors? Let's be realistic, my brothers and sisters.
Now, to discuss more on the massive exodus of Zimbabwean healthcare professionals, we contacted Tendai Ruben Bofana, a social justice activist and writer. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam. Now, first, can you tell us how serious is the exodus of Zimbabwean health professionals?
Yes, in Zimbabwe, it's very serious. I can say for the past 20 years, ever since the turn of the millennium, there's been a major exodus of healthcare professionals. And it's been a major setback for the country. We've seen most of the healthcare professionals, especially nurses, trained nurses and doctors, most of them have been living for neighboring South Africa. Quite a number have been taken up by the National Health Services in the United Kingdom. So you'll find that most of our healthcare professionals have been moving either to South Africa or to the United Kingdom, but it's really been bad, especially over the past 20 years. So it has left our healthcare system really crippled.
Over the last 20 years, the United States and European Union sanctions on the economy of Zimbabwe have hindered the enjoyment of fundamental human rights, including access to health. During her visit to Zimbabwe last year, UN Special Rapporteur Elena Doohan elaborated on how these sanctions have triggered an exodus of qualified health professionals.
I note with concern that due to the unavailability of new machinery and spare parts, the immigration of competent staff, and the unavailability of financial resources for medical expenses, the people of Zimbabwe have limited access to public transportation, electricity, water, and health care, affecting besides economic and social rights, the right to the health and to life, especially in the course of pandemic. The same reasons impede access to safe drinking water and sanitation, resulting in the increasing risks of cholera, COVID-19, and other diseases. The negative impact of unilateral sanctions is exacerbated multiple times by the de-risking policy of banks, donors, and trade and cooperation partners, resulting in overcompliance, reportedly impeding the possibility of citizens of Zimbabwe and private businesses to participate in international cooperation and professional or sport trainings and exchanges, affecting thus the right to education and the possibility of professional growth. By preventing the flow of investment to Zimbabwe because of higher reputational risks, the number of working places is negatively affecting, that resulting in external migration and involvement in the informal economy. I'm concerned that the use of extraterritorial secondary sanctions and reported fear of sanctions result in overcompliance with existing sanctions regimes, preventing the government of Zimbabwe, its public sector, and private companies from purchasing machinery, spare parts, medicine, food, agricultural supplies, and other essential goods.
Are the US-led sanctions that have badly impacted on the Zimbabwean economy to blame for this massive resignation of doctors and nurses?
It would be very disingenuous for anyone to ignore the impact of the illegal sanctions imposed by the United States on the country since the beginning, again, the turn of the century. So it's not by coincidence that after the imposition of these sanctions, then we started facing all these myriads of economic problems. It's not a coincidence, because this is the same government that we've had since 1980. Things were relatively okay. 1990s, relatively okay. Yes, there were problems just like any other nation. We complained of this and that. But after the turn of the century, when these sanctions were imposed, the economy just went on a free fall. The same people in power, the same mismanagement, the same corruption, but the nosedive of the economy showed that there was something extra, something powerful that was behind it.
Zimbabwean officials say the exodus of healthcare professionals has affected an already fragile health system, which suffers from a lack of medical equipment and medicines. Now, the World Health Organization recommends a minimum of 23 doctors per 10,000 people. Zimbabwe is far from meeting this target. During the last survey in 2015, there was an average of just 1.6 doctors per 10,000 people. Now, the situation has worsened. How has this migration of healthcare professionals affected the health sector in Zimbabwe?
You can just see the impact goes far beyond just an individual failing to access certain health facilities. For example, as I've already mentioned, maternity. So if you find that a woman who's going to a hospital or any healthcare facility expected to give birth and they pass on, usually that means the country has lost that woman and that child, and those are people who are expected to contribute positively to any economic growth of any country. So you find even recently with the COVID-19 pandemic that we've experienced over the past year and a half since the first case was identified in March last year, we've lost a lot of people, and most of those people, I believe, they could have been saved if we had enough ventilators in our hospitals. I'm talking now of equipment.
While many health professionals have left Zimbabwe for better salaries and working conditions abroad, many more have chosen to remain to serve their country during the COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking last September during a ceremony to honor health workers involved in the fight against COVID-19, Dr. Shingai Nyagusu, president of Senior Hospital Doctors Association, thanked her colleagues for their sacrifice.
I would also like to acknowledge all health workers nationwide who have been giving their all in this fight against COVID, often under very difficult conditions with very little reward.
Speaking during the same event, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa noted that the perseverance and commitment by Zimbabwe's healthcare workers in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic is remarkable. He said the government has been making all efforts to improve the conditions of service for the healthcare workers in order to retain staff. However, he noted that COVID-19 has impacted on the plans to uplift the public healthcare sector.
Most of the gains made in the health sector have suffered greatly due to threats related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Many nations are in turmoil. Zimbabwe, like many other countries, has not been spared from the unprecedented scourge, as we witnessed a sharp increase in number of infection cases and deaths to levels we had not anticipated. To date, Zimbabwe has recorded a total of 5,366 deaths.
What is the government doing to try and stop this ongoing exodus of doctors who have been trained using the country's resources?
What the government can do, quite frankly, is limited. The logical answer to that would be, and just give them the money they want, or just give them the money that they believe they deserve as trained professional healthcare workers. So it becomes a problem. I don't know if I can put too much of a burden on the government itself and say, do this, so that people, these healthcare professionals, not leave except give them the salary that they will be satisfied with, give them the remuneration that will make them feel worthy and comfortable so that they will be able to take care of their family. They will not leave. But as long as the government says we don't have the money for that, then they will always be leaving. They will always be leaving.
The past two decades have seen a worrying growth in the migration of African health professionals, especially nurses and doctors. They are particularly attracted to Western countries offering higher wages, as this Nigerian doctor explains.
It's going to be very difficult to find another Professor Hakim in the profession. All we can do as a profession is to continue, you know, growing the profession right from the medical school and keep on training individuals who have the potential to become their own unique professionals in the contribution to health.
While these healthcare professionals might be having problems in their countries, but their recruitment by mostly Western countries has been termed as immoral and inconsiderate to the health of African people. Now, what's your take on the move by Western countries to recruit African health workers while ignoring the negative impact of these recruitment?
Yes, unfortunately, the world is a cruel place, let's be honest. Especially with the Western countries, they don't have much of a history with Africa. Their history has been tainted since the days of slavery. So, and then we moved on to colonialism. So from my perspective, the West sees Africa and Zimbabwe, Africa in general, and Zimbabwe in particular, is just a hunting ground for resources, cheap labor. So it hasn't stopped. It can come in more sophisticated and polished packaging and ways of doing it, instead of the 17th or 18th century where they came with ships and put chains around our necks and shipped us off to the Caribbean and everywhere else. Now they'll just dangle, you know, cash and say, oh, come to the United Kingdom, come to our countries, we'll give you this money, leave your countries because you are being mistreated.
Well, Mr. Ambofana there says Western countries are engaged in modern-day slavery by recruiting African health workers who are desperately needed in their countries. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Thanks a lot, Mr. Ambofana, for your time. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the family cause of peace. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the family being the cause of peace in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the narrations and the verses, we look a lot of verses and narrations which talk about the family and family being the place of peace. Not only peace, but obviously this peace in the family brings rewards for the family. You know, the way there are some games there, like you get some points and then you have some bonus points. So you get the points, like the husband and wife by marrying, they have the points that they chose the halal way of, having the lust or entertainment or the peace in their life, in the personal life, either it's a sexual or it's the affection part, no matter which part is that, but it is through halal way. On the other hand, he gets the bonuses, the husband and wife gets the bonuses in the Islamic lifestyle. And because we are talking about this world and hereafter, this is very important to pay attention to words or actions, because these actions have rewards. And the family is the best way of earning a lot of rewards from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when you get a lot of rewards, then we get the inner peace, because the spirit itself, the ruh that we have, it gets the peace by those actions and by those rewards. And Allah brings peace into our souls or spirits because of the family and the peace that we have in the family, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the peace of the family. The family is the cause of peace. And we said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has brought the peace, and also He rewards us because of this family, because of this peace. There are many narrations. For example, in one of the narrations, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that when a man sits next to his family and he eats food with the family, it is better than many other things. So basically, it is better than the i'tikaf. You know, generally we go for i'tikaf in the mosque in the month of Ramadan. And on the other hand, it says when a husband places a piece of food in the mouth of her wife, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala likes it the most than He gives the reward of the i'tikaf in the mosque of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That he has done i'tikaf in the mosque of the Prophet, Masjid al-Nabi in the Medina. Now, what is i'tikaf? I'tikaf means that we stay for 3 days, or we can say like 10 days, or at least it's a 3 days, in the mosque where we fast during the day and during the night we pray, and we do not get involved in any kind of worldly, we can say like actions or the dealings, and purely praying the God for those 3 days where we are fasting and praying only. So when a man puts a small piece of food, or when he's putting up food, places of food in the mouth of the wife with the love, Allah loves this the most. And this brings love and peace in the family. And it makes the relation firm. It firms the relation of the wife and the husband. And this is what Islam is talking about. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The New York Times has recently reported that with Omicron surging in the US, economists warn that the 1-2 punch of expiring aid and rising cases could put a chill on the once red-hot economic recovery and cause severe hardship for millions of families already living close to the poverty line. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Huge Increase in U.S. Child Poverty Feared as Tax Credit Expires Amid Omicron Wave. Stay tuned for more. The lapse of Democrats' expanded child tax credit program at the end of last month has progressive lawmakers and advocates vocally warning of a major spike in child poverty in the new year, just as the Omicron variant wreaks havoc across the U.S., fueling a staggering rise in infections and hospitalizations. While some research suggests the highly transmissible Omicron strain causes less severe disease than other mutations, the enormity of the current wave is driving fears of widespread and potentially sustained societal disruptions, with disproportionate impacts on families without the resources to weather more pandemic-induced economic chaos. Approved as part of the coronavirus relief package that Biden signed into law in March 2021, the enhanced child tax credit provided eligible families with monthly payments of up to $300 per child under the age of 6 and $250 per child between the ages of 6 and 17. Recent survey data indicates that the payments brought millions out of poverty and helped many low-income families afford food. But thanks to the opposition of Senator Joe Manchin and every congressional Republican, the program expired at December's end, cutting off a key lifeline at what anti-poverty activists see as the worst possible moment. Rhode Island Poor People's Campaign recently said yet another sign of the misaligned priorities of this country. Programs of social uplift are sacrificed to the war economy and militarism. The New York Times reported recently that with Omicron surging, economists warned that the one-two punch of expiring aid and rising cases could put a chill on the once red-hot economic recovery and cause severe hardship for millions of families already living close to the poverty line. Anna Lara, a mother of two young children in Huntington, West Virginia, told the Times that without the boosted CTC, it's going to be hard next month. Just thinking about it, it really makes me want to bite my nails to the quick, Lara said. Honestly, it's going to be scary. It's going to be hard going back to not having it. Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, wrote recently that it is totally unacceptable for the Senate to let the CTC lapse. In November, the House of Representatives passed the version of the Build Back Better Act that would extend the enhanced CTC payments for another year. Jayapal wrote, "The Senate must act quickly to pass the Build Back Better Act and restore the child tax credit for millions of families who are counting on it. The pandemic isn't over. The relief to withstand it shouldn't stop." More than a million people in the U.S. tested positive for coronavirus recently, a global daily record said. The Washington Post reported recently that more than 103,000 Americans were hospitalized with COVID-19, the highest number since late summer, when the Delta variant of the coronavirus triggered a nationwide surge in cases. Pediatric hospitalizations have also risen at an alarming rate during the Omicron wave. According to a recent analysis by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, nearly 10 million children are at risk of slipping back below the poverty line or deeper into poverty if Congress doesn't extend the monthly CTC payments. Without congressional action, the CTC will revert back to its previous and far more exclusionary form with yearly lump sum payments. The Senate Democratic leadership has vowed to move ahead with Build Back Better negotiations this month, but it's unclear how much progress will be made toward a final deal as Manchin continues to obstruct.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Lady Fatima's personality, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, February 19th, 2018.
The people of her time, of other times, and we in this era are not able to recognize the brilliance and splendor of her spirituality. The bright light of spirituality is not detected by everyone's eye. Our short-sighted and weak eyes are unable to see the luminosity of humanity in these great personalities. Therefore, we do not discuss the definition of Fatima's alayhi salam spirituality. However, in her ordinary life, there's an important point. On the one hand, as a Muslim woman, she perfectly performs her duties at home and behaves nicely towards her husband and children. On the other hand, as a zealous, tireless person, she acts for her cause. In political events, shortly after the death of her father, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, she went to the mosque, gave a speech, expressed her position, and defended her cause. Hence, she represented a marvelous fighting personality that is tireless, enduring, and tolerant. The third aspect of her life reveals her as a devotee of Allah, who performs prayers in the dark of the nights, uprises for Allah, and is humble before Allah.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Combining these three dimensions is the luminous point in the life of Fatima alayhi salam. She did not separate the three dimensions. Some people think that those who worship Allah are only concerned with prayer and worship and cannot be involved in politics. Or some people think that those women and men who are active in politics and the arena of jihad on the path of Allah, if a woman, she cannot perform her duties at home as a mother and a wife. And as a man, he cannot be a good businessman, husband, or a father. They think these qualities are contradictory. Whereas in the view of Islam, these aspects not only reveal that there are no contradictions, but they are also helpful towards achieving the perfect human personality.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Skuse, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
Daylight, we illuminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's chequered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had a especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner, but the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceived the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts expressed shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile,